Well, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the London School of Economics, and in particular on behalf of the Gender Institute, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Dr. Stella Weldon this evening. Weldon is a friend I've known for a number of years, and she is a very prominent psychotherapist and writer on the field of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, well known for her book published in 1988, Mother, Madonna, Whore, The Idealization and Denigration of Motherhood, which is a study of female sexual perversions, which is widely used in psychotherapy courses. She's currently president of the International Association for Forensic Psychotherapy. She's a consultant psychotherapist at the Portman Clinic, and she's the founding director of a course which is the first of its kind in the world, the diploma course on forensic psychotherapy, as well as being an honorary senior lecturer in forensic psychotherapy at the British Postgraduate Medical Federation. In 1987, she was made a fellow of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Miss Stella Weldon.
Thank you very much. I am very pleased to be here, and I thank you very much and the Institute to invite me here. I always look at the number of people in the, of course, the gender, how many men and how many women. And especially so since I just came back from Peru, where I was invited to attend the conference on masculinity and femininity. And it was an international conference. And the first day, there were four main speakers to talk about femininity and masculinity. The four of them, they were men. So I was quite furious, as a matter of fact, and interrogated the organization about this. And they told me, well, something to do with members or not members, and perhaps the papers were not as good. Somebody had presented the paper who actually spoke four or five different languages, was a woman, very powerful. So I said, OK, we'll look at this paper. And I realized why the paper had not been included in the first presentation. The paper was about masculinity as opposed to all the papers, though it was masculinity and femininity, all the papers had to do with femininity. Her paper was about masculinity and about male impotence. So I said to her, you must be joking. You will never be accepted to talk about this subject on the first day here. We'll never be thought to be good enough because we always have to feel so protected about, unprotective about whatever goes wrong with men and, you know. So, but I will have the difficult task to talk about the difficult subject, which is female dangerousness. And I believe that perhaps only women can do this. I feel that perhaps for men would be very difficult to talk about this particular subject. And I would like to preface my presentation with a newspaper cutting, which appeared in the Independent, October 1993, is widely known, the case of Beverly Allitt, a 24-year-old nurse who admitted to have killed four children and attacked nine other children, all of them in her ward under her care. It is a short piece in a first page in a serious paper, and there are details here, as you see. It's noted that at her trial, she was suffering from anorexia nervosa. Allitt had been inflicting serious injury on her own body while a student nurse. She was described by a home office forensic psychiatrist as this very damaged lady. I would like to point out here that being a woman may not fit in with our perception of a serial killer, which of course she is. The actual dangerousness in Beverly Allitt case is devastatingly obvious. What are the determinants for these horrific killings? What has been overlooked and even neglected? Could this violent behavior have been predicted earlier on? Were there circumstances which could have established a higher degree of risk, which would increase the chances for this dangerousness? And furthermore, is this dangerousness intrinsically female? And if so, why? How can we use this awful experience to discover possible ways to improve our means of accurately detecting and assessing dangerousness, or female dangerousness, and hence hopefully preempt further criminal behavior in the future. It might be useful to look at a description of the definition of dangerousness by a forensic psychiatrist. He's dead right now, Peter Scott. Definition of dangerousness. As you can see, it's an unpredictable, untreatable tendency to inflict or risk serious, irreversible injury or destruction, or to induce others to do so. Then gets this definition is widely used by many other psychiatrists. So it is very important to notice that usually everybody uses the first part, but not the second part, which says dangerousness can, of course, be directed against the self. Now, this omission, it seems to me quite a serious situation, because it seems to me that this is, as I will try then to bring it to you, to your attention, to do with female dangerousness. So this is a well-known definition, considered both practical and useful. Now, as we can see in the newspaper account, the history of Beverly Allett contained a horrific account of previous psychopathological features, which included self-mutilation, anorexia, sadomasochism, and especially in relation with men. She was known also to be a self-mutilator. So in other words, there were a lot of actions that were directed against herself. Had this new concept of female perversion been taken into account, a job involving mothering duties would have been clearly counterindicated. In other words, the fact that there was a history precedent to the actual taking care of that world, that the history was indicating that she had been directing different and serious attacks against her body, could have been put into the alert to other situations which have involved the children. Failure to understand the nature of female perversion has led some very damaged ladies being so misunderstood as to be denied the treatment they need and for which they sometimes plead. Such attitudes are amongst the reasons why it is taking so long for the profession, let alone the public, to accept that women as mothers or in mothering professions could inflict irreparable and permanent damage to the children they are supposed to take care. If you remember, battered baby syndrome had to wait until the 60s for its causology to be accurately diagnosed. Nobody could assume that the mothers could be involved in this serious damage inflicted onto the children. A massive denial that women could be capable of such actions was the rule. And interestingly, the recognition of this syndrome didn't come from the professionals dealing with women, didn't come from psychiatrists, didn't come from psychologists, but didn't come with anybody dealing with women with psychological problems, but from experienced pediatricians. In other words, people who were in charge of the care of the children involved, not of the mothers. So in other words, it's giving us some indication that perhaps it's very hard and very difficult to listen to women with this sort of predicaments, and that we are perhaps shutting them up. A comparable situation is today arising with the Munchausen syndrome by proxy, a discovery made by Professor Meadows, who again is a pediatrician. Until now, our new understanding of female perversions is effectively used women with severe distress and difficulties who have no access to professional help because of the complete disbelief of those around her. This misconception of perversion leaves children unprotected. Today, there is a new development in which women previously and unusually known to suffer from specific predicaments in their mothering functioning or dysfunctioning are now heard and diagnosed more accurately. This follows my own hypothesis that motherhood itself is sometimes chosen for unconscious perverse reasons. As I wrote, the woman would know that in achieving motherhood, she is automatically achieving the role of master, that of being in charge, in complete control of another human being who has to submit himself or herself not only emotionally, but also biologically to the mother's demands, however inappropriate they may be. We may now ask, do we today have the conditions to recognize these specific problems, to assess accurately female dangerousness, and to acknowledge risk circumstances which could establish patterns that are familiar to us from pre-existing ones, which could act as indicators of future dangerous behavior in which hostility and aggression could easily be triggered off? Tonight, I will limit myself to exploring the intricacies of dangerousness in this particular case, since it is now through media in the public domain. However, I would like to point out that this presentation will be based on the psychological clinical findings of women referred for assessment to the Portman Clinic in the last 4 years, with the presenting problem of physical or sexual abuse towards their own children or to other children. For reasons of confidentiality, I cannot give details. These findings corroborate the previous decade of diagnostics of 40 women, which trigger off my own concern about the same condition. This is we consider a progress report, since patients' data is still in the research stage. So I will try to offer some descriptive survey containing some referral models, some early psychopathology elicited from the interview with these women, together with a high index of suspicion, and a deliberate engaging in self-harm will be discussed. I would like to, first of all, to explain what do I mean by perversion. This is more or less what I would like to do, but obviously I won't have time to get into all that, but these are my areas of interest in which I am working. Now, perversion in our own language is a psychoanalytical term used without any pejorative indication. It's a clinical entity in which the person is suffering from perversion, the person who is afflicted by this particular problem, as opposed to people who seemingly, they seem to think that people who are involved in perverse actions or in perverse situations, they are having a wonderful time. They are people who are really suffering an enormous amount in their own internal world. And we have to remember about their own internal world in order to get the awareness of what this person goes through. Again, if we just remember the other case of the other person who committed suicide accidentally with the self-deliberate auto-asphyxia, if you remember, a very well-known case too. So what happens is that the sexual anxiety is the motor. First, the person starts having an enormous amount of sexual anxiety, which triggers off sexual fantasy. Usually it's the same one. Same sexual fantasy is on going on there. And it's quite fixed, especially this is for men. They are not at all aware what is going on wrong with them, but they have that. And we don't understand, they don't understand either why they are subjected to this particular thing. So they start fighting against that because really they know that this is not right for them or for society. So it's not for anybody to say, don't do it, because they know that they shouldn't do it, because it is really, they suffer a lot about that, and they are fighting against that, and the jargon we call against, in other words, is ego dystonic. It's against the ego, the sort of the well-being, let's say, of the ego. But the anxiety grows bigger and bigger. That person gets more and more anxious. It reaches a peak of sexual anxiety, and at that point, the ego is corrupted, let's say. The superego gets involved there too, the action becomes ego dystonic, and the person succumbs to the action, to the perverse action. At that point, the person obtains sexual gratification. Now, as opposed to what would happen in a situation of making love, having sex, in which the two partners might experience a sense of well-being that approximates them further and makes them feel some sort of a situation that is rich for both of them. In this case, what happens at that person after the sexual gratification is very short-lived. It's ephemeral there. And it's immediately replaced by a feeling of shame, depression, self-disgust. So in other words, it gets again into ego dystonic. What happens again is the anxiety is there again. As you can see, it's a very, very hard life that these people go through in their own, and it's completely encapsulated most of the times. So nobody knows about this action. And these are some of the characteristics that we see in clinical work of perversion. So the desired intention to engulf the other person, dehumanization, the person doesn't see the other as a real, as another person, but as a part of himself. Making hate instead of making love, so it's a hostility. It's a desire to intrude and to invade. Again, the inability to see the other person as a human, as a separate being, to be in complete control of the situation always, and to merge with the other. In other words, fantasies are not enough to make any definition or qualification about perversion. They have to be, the body has to be engaged. As you see, all these different characteristics could really apply to some women when they get pregnant or they have children. Unfortunately, we all seem to think that, you know, even all the colleagues, that the pregnancy is always a sign of mental health, and it's good mental health and it's stabilizing. And then we make mistake about this glorification of motherhood, in which then, if women are pregnant, that's fine. The only person who knows about that pregnancy, and sometimes does, is the person who is pregnant, whether she has got some other sort of ideas in her mind to get pregnant or not. Now, that would be the most important areas of division in between men and women, would be those ones in which then you can see that the aim in men is always, the goal is always aim at an outside object, whereas in women is either themselves or objects of their own creation, their babies. The onset is usually at an early age, whereas in women could be at vulnerable stages. There's a lack of freedom in the object choice. A man has to perform a certain function all the time. It's absolutely fixed there. Whereas the women have got much more degree of changeability in their object choice. Men, they have no emotional or physical attachment to the object or part object that is the perversion as itself. Whereas the women, they do have. In men, usually, they don't involve sexual intercourse. In women, they could, as again, for fantasy purposes and as a means to produce a perverse scenario. In men, interference at all times with all other areas, including volition, thought processes, and affects. This, again, encapsulated. So he can go on with his life all over, but at different times, he's taken over completely. And at women, it's much more in times of emotional crisis. In men, sometimes it's not really stress-related. It's a desire to harm others, but obviously it is absolutely unconscious. So this is not really a conscious situation, whereas in the women is desire to harm themselves or their babies or bodies. Persist through life. I said the women in general, they have better prognosis, but I will explain how. I will give you now two clinical examples, which will, I think, will make it much easier for you to see what I mean in men and women. This is a 34-year-old man, referred himself to the clinic, complaining of intense and irresistible urges to touch and caress the breasts of women unknown to him. So we have to listen to very, very strange things every day in our practice. Eh? Very, very strange things. And I tell you, they are the people who are suffering from this condition, they are also very perplexed, and they are in a terrible depression too. They don't know why they experience this. A very alien, bizarre things. He indulged in this in crowded public places, typically while traveling in underground trains at rush hour. He would station himself close to the train door and would furtively fondle a stranger's breasts, poised to fail if she began to protest, to go away. He had never been apprehended, but nevertheless experienced shame and self-disgust after such episodes, although he felt unable to resist the urges. He was excited by all stages of his action, including the anticipation, planning, choosing his victim, and the woman's reaction. The reason for this consultation was bizarre, but revealing of the nature of perversion. A few weeks earlier, he had begun to touch a woman's breast in an underground train, but failed to elicit any response from her. He daringly began to fondle her breast, but felt confused when she still failed to react. Other passengers began to stare at Anne, the woman. Finally, alert to the indignity of the situation, did not shout, but placed her own hand onto her breast and pulled, demonstrating that he actually had been fondling her prostheses, a false breast. And then she said very sarcastically, "If this is what you want, you can have it." And began to laugh. You can see the demonstration of the part object, you know, this, all these jargon words there, in which the man is so interested in finding this breast, and really, you know, he's failing to. So the man was overcome with intense shame. He had never experienced such a humiliation. He recalled that when he was 3 years old, his mother transferred all attention to his newborn sister and ridiculed him for wanting to feed from her breast. Now, if we see, before we go into the motherhood, if we see this another example, which is, again, I see that it's extremely revealing about the difference between a woman of 26 told me how she fantasized about cutting up strange men's bodies, how she would approach and con her prospective victims with devious maneuverings in order to gain their cooperation for fake enterprises, whilst all along she would be harboring murderous designs. She boasted about being extremely dangerous and even claimed to have killed a few people, but it was impossible to know whether this was mere fantasy. What is her real problem? She eats herself to severe obesity. She cuts and burns herself in all parts of her body. Some of these injuries are in her sexual areas, and the pain inflicted produces in her much sexual pleasure, or let's say, perhaps sexual release. Other injuries are in exposed areas of her body, which are obvious to any passers-by. To start with, she attempted to rationalize such behavior by claiming that in this way she protects others against her murderous wishes. However, when we began to explore at a deeper level, she then reluctantly admitted that what she really gains from others staring at her sometimes raw and open self-inflicted wounds is a great sense of gratification and pleasure at eliciting other people's looks of distress and discomfort. She claims she's trying to punish the whole world by harming her own body. But of course, in her assertion, she dismisses her own self-inflicted damage. This is a typical psychological trait of female perversion, being both sadistic and masochistic in her perverse actions. On another occasion, while driving her car, a motorbike driver reacted angrily at being threatened by her reckless driving. Suddenly and with difficulty, she managed to ease herself out of her small car. He stopped, stared at her in amazement, and said with complete contempt, "Your body is a disgusting spectacle, especially considering that in all the third world countries, people are dying of famine. You are obscene." At once, her turbulent rage was replaced by a flow of bitter tears. She was furious, but felt caught, since she immediately recognized that her treatment of her body was so obviously seen, not only as an angry action against herself, but also against the whole world. A deep insight into her murderousness was easily available, so making it impossible for her to continue with the same old litany. Quote, "If somebody tells me that it is wrong to burn or cut myself, I tell them that I don't see anything wrong with it. My body belongs to me and it's only under my control." These statements represent the woman's voice of dissent, which she fears cannot be heard in any other way except by inflicting physical injury upon herself. Her predicament is yet another example of women's hurting their own bodies in their quest for control and power, however bitter the outcome. As you can see, then the problem is that women are really, as you see, some of the expression of basic emotions are sort of self-prescribed and self-proscribed. Men are supposed to, you know, to be angry and to get whatever they want by being, it's called to be self-assertive. Whereas women are supposed to cry in order to get whatever they want. Nobody would say when women start shouting that this is a degree of mental health are being achieved or a sort of you know, they are doing much better. This is very self-assertive. Even some of my colleagues, psychoanalysts, they would be very angry. Their wives start shouting and expressing themselves in angry ways, though they are expected to do that. So women, they have that chance, usually when they get so angry, and they are so impotent, and they feel so so absolutely, utterly despondent, is the children, you see. Because the children, and you know perfectly well, you are in any public place, and you see a woman doing something to her own child, and you don't dare to intervene, because the woman will tell you, mind your own business, this is my child. So we are all very much sort of falling into the situation of being a sort of silent conspiracy. So I would say that a sort of high index of suspicion, that sometimes, you see, I say that the problem is that since the women are being silenced in all these different situations of frustration and not having any access to any other power, that sometimes there were a lot of revenge. They had dreams of revenge that nobody gets to know because they don't want to know about this either. Mm? But just remember the whole case about Mary and Jason, and you will remember very well what happened there with the children and Jason, and how then Jason, so that she was so now, Medea was so absolutely wonderful that she was had acquired some sanity, being able to listen to his plans about, you know, what to do about getting married to this princess and having the children better off, etc., etc. So then she killed him. So I would say that perhaps we have to look at problems with women when they are with too many demands, inability to cope, awareness of helplessness, hopelessness, despondency, and despair. And I think that in that sort of predicament, their conscious revenge will go either against their own bodies, so eating disorders, deliberate self-harm, self-cutting, self-burning, self-mutilation, or promiscuity. And I am talking about the promiscuity which women, they feel that they never get anywhere, anything, and that they are in complete state of frustration again and again and again. Because promiscuity is not either a sort of the great sort of sexual hedonism that people seem to imply. And otherwise, if not to have bodies, to have babies. Women are very much aware, and this will be physical sexual abuse, Umhouse syndrome by proxy, but I just believe that this perhaps belongs to another category, which are much more seriously disturbed, the women involved in that. And I mean disturbed in the sense of much more sort of near psychotic. Now, so in the conceptualization of female perversion, let's say, I think that in both men and women, the reproductive functions and organs are used for perversion. The man uses the penis to carry out his perverse activities, while the woman uses her whole body because her female reproductive sexual organs are more widely spread. So these differences, I think they have to do also with all different sort of an enormous amount of multitude of causes which are determining how different we are in different ways, and some of them we can change and some of them we can't. But certainly there are many of them that we can change. So after years of clinical experience, I have had to acknowledge that there are feelings or activities in among women that could or must be called perverse, even if the mental mechanisms are different from those on men. So the acknowledgement of female perversion has been absent, though the evidence is that male perversion is often the result of early faulty mothering. Why is it so difficult to conceptualize the notion of perverse motherhood and other female perverse behavior according to a complete different psychopathology which originates from the female body and its inherent attributes? Since men had appealed to perversion as a way to deal with the fear of losing their penis, women were left in a position in which perversions were not available to them. The old popular statement, women cannot have sexual perversions if they don't possess penises, was seldom queried. Freud theorized that the Oedipus complex was resolved in little girls when they fantasized about having daddy's babies inside themselves. The symbolic equivalence of penis baby was created. Developing these ideas, we could say provocatively that women cannot have perversions because they can have babies. I mean, it's just been absolutely transposed, the whole psychology of men and psychopathology of men into women. And all has been overemphasized, and I believe not overemphasized, but absolutely wrongly emphasized, the penis envy from girls to boys. as if we also had nothing else. You know, it's a bit, it's not very subtle, let's say, you know, to forget about all our own richness of our own inherent attributes, our own female bodies and mental mechanisms, just to say, you know, it's exactly the same without it. So, it seems to me that we have to look into this into a different way. For example, the psychopathologies most frequently associated with women are syndromes of self-injury, associated with disorders affecting the reproductive functioning, as I have already mentioned. They are also, the menses, they are, the menstrual periods, are acting as indicators of the severity of the condition. We have to remember also that women, when they, it's a very, very strange that women, when they commit these actions, they suffer an enormous amount. They would go through enormous extremes to really to save their babies from their own attacks. So the problem is that they are not being listened by professionals or by anybody. That's one of the problems. That is, that I said we tend to immediately to identify with this unwanted, neglected, ill-treated child, and then we just stop listening to the women in this situation because it is too painful for us to listen to them. And we are leaving women in these predicaments in a very difficult situation without an absolutely absence of any help. Now, it seems to me that it does occur when this occurs, the perverted motherhood, as I call it, as a breakdown of inner mental structures. The mother feels not only emotionally crippled in dealing with all these huge psychological and physical demands from her baby, but also impotent and unable to obtain gratification from other sources. She perceives, and actually I think that she perceives that she sees the world around her as non-existent in any helping or supporting way. And it is then that she feels completely powerless. So simultaneously and paradoxically, she experiences her perverse behavior as a mother as the only power available to her through her exclusive emotional and physical authority over her baby. I believe that it's very important that perverse motherhood must be seen as the product of the emotional inability and inadequate individuation brought about by a process that involves at least three generations. So we have to look into at least three generations back, also in order not to be at all judgmental. We could easily fall into a situation of being judgmental and to forget, you know, that there are people who are in need of help and they are, and to blame mothers, for example, like happened before with the, in the R.D. Lang's theories that immediately the mothers, they were immediately sort of abused by the public and were told that they were the responsible ones for the child to become schizophrenic. And it seems to me that then they forget about that the mothers, they had also, some mothers had faulty mothering from before and previous again. So we have to have it sort of quite a look into the past, going to generations, not just going to one. Let me see, I have got some few. Well, I don't know, this is much more clinical. What we would do, let's say, to a diagnostic approach, which I think is very difficult with some of women. As you know, it is usually it is an unwanted baby. Most of the times, it's generations and generations, they have been waiting for that boy to come. So the girl comes, and so it's quite important to know whether the girl was a wanted baby or not. And so all these, which are much more sort of a clinical situation, it seems to me that it's rather important in order to see what happened. Of course, also where the girls, they were thought to be to go to university or to have education or not, because that also will indicate clearly how then undermined the position of women in that family or in that the whole family situation was too. And then when they have their own children, I think that this is very important to make also a sort of because I think that the problem is that women have not been asked about these questions. And then if you don't ask, you never get the questions. But again, this is very much a clinical situation, which I am trying to share with you some of the clinical findings in order for you to become aware about problems that you might not be at all aware, since they are not touching you in any of your works of professional or domesticity. I think that the problem is that it's very difficult to conceive of predictability when society is totally unprepared to deal with this emergency, such as in the case of glorification of motherhood. And if we remember the case of Beverly Allitt and the horrific history of self-mutilation she had when she was a student nurse, and she also was suffering from anorexia nervosa, if we had had this concept about a sort of precedental psychopathological features which were previous to that, obviously, for example, that doesn't mean that they are going to become female abusers. I don't mean that. But I mean that we will be much more careful about what sort of profession. After all, the victims, you know, and the offense is being made by victims and by society, and all of us, we are very much part of this. So what are we providing people with that then this could happen? And then in that particular case, it seems to me rather important that this young woman was being given a job in which could easily, if you had had the idea that, you know, a sort of a development is taking place in which then could be sought to, you know, to go into one direction, that perhaps she could should have been helped not to get into that profession, not to be taking care of young children. And I am talking now in general, but the newspaper account is a very easy one because obviously everybody knows about this. I think that it has been completely misunderstood, all this, and that these attitudes are among the reasons why it's taking so long for the profession, let alone the public, to accept that women as mothers or in mothering professions can inflict irreparable and permanent damage to the children they are supposed to take care of. Now, it seems important also to develop a personality profile, then to be able to look into this particular problem too, and to see what goes on that in the domesticity, what goes on when the woman is alone at home with the children. How then, what sort of provisions are being made for them? I go into the anamnesis, and I think it's rather important because they do come they do write letters. I have a letter there in a briefcase. I have three or four letters, as a matter of fact, which might be more, which might give you, again, more clear indications how, since it is, got in touch with the NSPCC, she said, when Felix of Arauz and in certain situations with Matthew, my 18-month-old son, started a couple of weeks ago, she is very aware. She doesn't know how to control herself. She wants to do this. She's in treatment now. She wants to do it, and she finds herself completely unable at times. I mean, it is it's very, very, very difficult at times for them to do. I in a way, I said perhaps I'll give you. I'm trying to look for an example that is. For example, a patient came because of her uncontrollable and horrid urges to sexually abuse her own and other children. She tried very hard to stop herself, but not always successfully. She found that the most effective way to fight the urges off was by means of hurting herself really badly. She would tie herself in strings, ropes, and chains in an attempt to immobilize herself and then masturbate, thus gaining some sort of relief for her anxiety. The patient was a mother of three children. When she first got pregnant, she hated it, having all kinds of fantasies about what kind of monster baby she could produce. She began to tie herself in ropes and would hang from the stairs in the hope that the fetus would drop and an abortion would ensue. The patient herself had been sadistically, sexually, and physically abused by her mother, who used to introduce pieces of sharp metal and glasses into her vagina and anus. She had then seen sexual abuse by many people, especially those who she would trust, such as members of the clergy, teachers, and other responsible adults. So what I am trying to bring awareness is this sort of situation I think it's very difficult really to talk about this, to share the experience, because I think it's very, very difficult to listen to these two. And I would go to the family tree, and okay, so that's what I say, that they have a lot of problems about inability to obtain operational help because of. Now, this last one, it is true, it's still the same. People, they have a tendency to call problem women hysterics, manipulators, inadequate attention seekers. So, in other words, it's very, very much used against any real understanding of women. So I say this is motivated, as I have mentioned before, by the glorification of motherhood, in which then mothering is equal to good mental health. And this leads to the perpetuation of seeing women as victims, never allowed to disclose dreams of revenge or abuse of power and controlling attitudes. So it's a perpetuation of women being seen as victims and never allowed to disclose this. Now what happens then is that it's an outcome of a split in which women are always being seen as victims, men as perpetrators. So women, they get shut up by being given medication, and men being shut up by being put into prison. So, but there are two different sort of situations to deal with. Women, they have access only to domestic power, where abuse is hidden away, without possibilities for emotional and practical resources. Men, they have access to public power. So the transgression is in the open. Punishment and humiliation are the natural sort of resources. So I would just say that the powers are unequally distributed, with women's exclusive power to the domestic sphere, where abuse is hidden away, and possibilities for practical, emotional resources out. Men's access to public power, as I said before, with transgressions into the open, with the natural concomitant of humiliation and punishment being the available resources. The outcome of the split affects individuals and society in general. Since women are to be the victims, being treated with sedatives, men always as perpetrators, faced with penalization and punishment. So the new awareness and deeper insights in women's psychopathologies are available now and should be used in a positive way to promote further understanding and prevention of these particular conditions. More adequate resources should be available and should be made available to provide appropriately for mothers and babies. This should be our aim to prevent further abuses of domestic power, which cause much pain, suffering, and distress to both mothers and babies in the short run and society in general in longer terms. Once more, we will see that perversion is very much intertwined with the politics of power. Women have access to domestic power, where men have access to public power. A close cooperation between all those professionals who care for either mothers and or babies is needed to secure both accurate diagnosis and adequate provisions. This should be aimed to prevent further abuses of domestic power, which cause much pain. And I would just like to leave this message with you about being able to be aware about this particular problem, and also to be aware about a lot of women who are in need to be able to talk about these problems. And I think that they are being shut up by all of us, as a matter of fact, because since all this has come into the open, a lot of people are referring themselves directly for treatment, because even when I place them into a group with other patients, the other patients cannot believe that they can do this. Now, after a while, then the tradition has been now in the group too, be able to listen to much, much more carefully. But for a long time, people would say, oh, don't be silly. It's maternal instinct, don't be silly. You don't have any of that. That's silly. No, don't worry about that. So that's all the message I want to give to you. And thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Estella, for a very challenging and stimulating talk. And one of the many insights which I think came out of it was the way you punctured the illusion that people, by making some dramatic change in their life, such as having a child, could actually resolve the problem, whereas, as was so evident from your talk, you merely take the problem with you and make someone else pay the price. As such, transitions are all too common. Well, we have 10 or 15 minutes before the reception. Who would like to ask any questions? Yes, please.
Thank you.
I think that the onset, for example, and also the fixity in men is far, more fixed, really. You can see that women, because I think that in my own, I mean, in my own ideas, is that I think that what is for both is that both, in a way, are against a sort of my maternal figure, very, very unconsciously so, in other words, you know, but it's very much against a sort of, it's never really against a man, as a matter of fact. It's always against the sort of the mother figure who has, you know, been giving birth, or the female body as such. But men, usually the perversions, they are carried out against women, and against women who are strange to them. Whereas, if you see, for example, even women who are exhibitionist, flashers, let's say, which I have had a number of them, they do it to only to women, and women that they are extremely fond of. So a very sort of, so it's a sort of rather, even though they could appear on the surface to be exactly the same, really, when you look into that, they are quite different. I have not seen any man who goes to the extent of cutting himself or doing something against himself in order not to produce pain to anybody else. I haven't seen any like that. Except, of course, in the cases you have of self asphyxia is, again, is something else to do with himself, but it's in a different, because in the body is directed, the body itself, it's is what it's providing the ejaculation, which is, and then also hypoasphyxia and all that, so it's all a different thing altogether. But I think there are some very clear distinctions between one gender and the other. And I think perhaps one has to look into psychopathology to see much more about the differences between the genders. But then you, sorry.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, I think you have touched a very important point there, because, for example, you made me think now about the women I have seen inflicted with Munchausen syndrome by proxy, which they are causing harm to their babies. Under the, you know, the idea that the babies are ill, and they take the babies to different hospitals, different doctors, for different very radical treatments. I just feel that I can't touch them. Where somebody comes and says, you know, I'm doing this, or you see that letter somebody writes, it's so self-evident that the suffering she's going through and the clarity that she has got about what she's doing, whereas as opposed to the other woman who is suffering from Munchausen syndrome by proxy, usually is quite unaware. And in that sense, that it's a sort of breaking down with reality, with a sense of reality inside herself, that, you know, she doesn't know what she's doing. So it's a sort of, and I would say that the very important situation, we have groups there with both perpetrators and victims of incest, not directly related. And the important situation we have become more and more aware of, for example, is that men, they become aware for the first time that these women, 40, 30, 50-year-old, they are still suffering through the abuse that has been inflicted to them, and they were, I think, genuinely quite unaware about this. Whereas women are so much more aware what they are doing, it will produce terrible problems to their children. So in that sense, the degree of suffering is quite different. And I think that is the reason that they have, in general terms, better prognosis.
Yes.
I don't know about the difference between then inflicted it onto men or women. I really, do you have anything in mind? That you have something in mind?
Nothing.
No, because what I have seen is that, let's say the women, I said women who have been, let's put it this way, I said victims of, let's say, victims of sexual abuse. The victims of sexual abuse by fathers would be far more compliant, which would be much more passive. Would be sort of, they will be much more difficult for them to show any self-assertion has been part of that. whereas the victims of maternal incest, they will appear to be okay, and then suddenly will be sudden outbursts of violence. I mean, and that they might kill people then. And so that the difference of the who was doing the inflicting the abuse, I think it's rather different. There are some few people who have written about this, especially in America, about the distinctions between the consequences of being a victim of a mother or being a victim of a father. And usually it's in psychotic breakdowns, the victims of mothers, or sometimes serial killers too. See, I think should be given much better provisions, people who are working with enormous amount of difficulties. I don't know why they are assuming immediately to be provided with a magic wand to be very badly paid, with very bad circumstances of working situations, and then to be working with most difficult people and not to have any problems, and not to have even supervision, not to have any sort of provisions of any help at all. And it seems to me that we just don't want to deal with that. So it's one way to be blind in order not to deal with the problems that they are dealing with. They identify themselves into the others then a lot of the times. They see sort of mirror spectrum of themselves there. And so they can fall into these sort of situations because it's very much a mirror image too. But I think that it's something that we do, that we don't want to be bothered. We don't become a very caring society in those cases, you see. See, this is related to this course we do, because in a way what happens is that people who are working in very, very difficult situations in mental hospitals, in prisons, in medium secure units, they have nothing at all, really. Nothing at all. They're not well equipped either to be dealing with a lot of terrible, terrible predicaments that suddenly they emerge. And that then they explode in the newspapers, and then everybody blames whatever, and then we are not taking care, really.
Mm. Yes.
I wonder if you believe that the increased isolation of women as housewives in households in this century compared to other centuries has increased the risks of very unhappy women becoming unhappier in isolation, and thus having, as isolated with their children in the suburbs, have sort of an increased ability to inflict harm on.
Sure. Yes, I see the situation of becoming more and more isolated. And also, I see that it's very hard for now. Let's say, before, all the women, most women, they were then at home taking care of children with mothers, with grandmothers and all that. Now it becomes more and more that some women, they are out. They are working, they go to university, and there are some of them at home. So that situation also becomes rather uneven, and rather they feel much more victims of a sort of social injustice in that way. And whatever self-assertion they might try, they might be met with complete deafness from their husbands or other associates, and they are absolutely alone. And I think it's very important to also to remark on the effect of accomplishments, because a lot of women who want to make accomplishments, also they have to deal with a lot of envious feelings from their own parents, which didn't have access to better their own professional lives, let's say. And I think that's very important too, and that, people are being pushed. If you see, for example, how often when it's a child dies, or is a very, very small infant, and the mother is immediately pushed to replace that child. I mean, it's not even allowed to have a process of sort of mourning. Nothing at all is taking place there, and you know, it's just being pushed like it was a sort of like she's being provided with a factory for making children. You know, people here, they don't replace a dog or a pet. As, you know, they just have a feeling that they have to remain for a longer time with that before they can be. But it's very strange about how we do separate sort of the body of the woman for having children, the body of the woman to for use of pornographic situations too, for example, which is all to do with, again, with society.
Yes.
I don't know. I really don't know. I haven't seen it. I mean, obviously, I see a lot of aggression when one goes to work, goes into competition, and goes into rivalry, and goes into, you know, to survive, you have to do all that. And when you're at home, you have all those feelings. You have to deal with them on your own there, which is rather more difficult. So in a way, what you have when you are going out to work, also you have a lot of frustration, but also you have a lot of discharge of other things, and you have achievements too, and satisfaction, that then you can really manage to create a much better balance for yourself then.
Lots of guilt.
A lot of guilt too, because that is still a long way to come before we can get rid of that.
Yes.
You see, I don't think they are pretext. I don't think at all. I would never say that their woman is taking the child with a pretext or using pretext. I say that they have, it's a problem, I think it's a very serious problem. They have a breakdown of sense of reality. And they do believe that the child, I mean, I'm talking about very serious cases, really. I'm not talking about, you know, sort of people who just be anxious about their children. I'm talking about very serious cases.
Excuse me, I'm just talking about somebody who might know all. Uh-huh.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. I see what you mean. Yeah. Yes, that's quite different. And I said, you see, for example, she doesn't feel free to say, look, I need to have a break, and what can I do about that? She has to say that the child is ill. You see what I mean? The guilt is such, that she cannot admit to herself that she's had enough and that perhaps she needs a break. Without having to send the child to be provided by somebody, by some services, that the child can go somewhere and she can have a break for 4 days without having to have the child ill. See what I mean? Yeah.
One last question. Yes.
But you were talking about a society in which then women or mothers favor their. You are talking about a society in which mothers would favor boys, their sons. Oh, yeah. Yes. But I think you are saying exactly what I have been describing too, in a way, that that's the problem, that women who feel so dispossessed of power, then they have to use that child as a source of power in itself, you see. And sometimes with the very, very, very bad consequences, because that child who seems to be the one that is a paradoxical situation in which that is the child who is giving her power, and at the same time, that power, she's abusing of that power and using and abusing the child. Well, I mean, that's what the treatment situation is another matter altogether, because it takes a long time, and I usually do this treatment in groups, because it seems to me that, as you say yourself, I say it's very important in any sort of normative situation for the mother to have a child with the idea that the child will grow out and will become an independent being. Well, these mothers, they tend to have the child completely in a very symbiotic situation and completely under their control. So in treatment, it seems to me that it's much easier to have them in a group in which the situation of authority, the sort of the mother and the child, they are not alone. They are the peer. There are peers there to be together. So they have the chance also to see other peers doing much better and leaving the group and being helped to and facilitated the separation with the group and the treatment situation too. So we're talking about a very long-term treatment, really, in which people, they do in different ways. I mean, the stages of differentiation and individuation, they are different ones for every one of them. But I think it's very important that they have something different from what they have had before. Anyway, that woman, for example, I would say that it's very important to look into the three generations prior to her. And perhaps she was the first one to bring a boy into that family household, you see. So then it's the prejudice from the other older generations, a prejudice of enormous amount of envy and hostility too. They want to have a baby boy, and at the same time, if they haven't had anyone for three generations, they are going to be extremely, I want to put a lot of prejudice on that woman too. You see, so it's all, we have to look into each case individually about that, yeah.
I fear we have to come to a conclusion now. I'd like to thank Estella very much. Many of the points you raised would have prompted all of us to think of other things that one encounters in life. I must say the emphasis on the word envy, however blind one is as a tutor of students, the envy of parents of the students is something which one has to be very blind indeed, not occasionally to notice. The timing of divorces in the final year of examinations is not unknown in the world of higher education, no doubt, in order to remind the children of who really has power. There's not much one can do about it. But I think one has to be grateful to you for all the work you've done and are doing, and wish you all the best. And thank you very much for speaking to us this evening.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
There is a reception, I think, on the fifth floor, in the senior common room on the fifth floor, to which you are all cordially invited, without discrimination or...